I'm Alice Brooks, the director of photography for Wicked, and this is the Cinematography Podcast.
The following podcast contains explicit language. You're listening to the Cinematography Podcast presented by Hot Rod Cameras, a program about the art, craft, and philosophy of the moving image and the people who make it happen. Coming to you from the world headquarters of Hot Rod Cameras in Hollywood, California, are your hosts, Ben Rock and Ilya Friedman.
Hey there, Ben Rock.
Hey, Ilya Friedman. How's it going?
It's going all right. How about you?
Never better.
Never better. All right. That's
never ever. high bar.
Hey, who's on the show today?
Well, that's why I would say never better. We have the amazing and talented and brilliant Alice Brooks. And
back again.
I would be shocked.
That's great.
Yeah. We had her on for In the Heights, and now she's on for Wicked Part One. And I will be personally shocked if this does not get nominated for Best Cinematography. It's such great work.
It is. I just saw it, and it's a really great looking movie. So for sure, I think that there's a lot going for it. I would be shocked as well. I think it's going to get all kinds of praise.
I think so, and it's doing super well at the box office, that's cool. But I think it's a movie that's really worth seeing. And you know, I say this as someone who anyone listening to this knows that I'm probably a bigger fan of horror than Broadway musicals.
What?
And yet, I was fully ensorcelled by this movie. I was taken right in. I think it's awesome. I think it looks great. I think the performances are great. Alice has some amazing, amazing stories. There's one like right towards the end of the interview that people should hear. I know that sounds like clickbait, but it was like we had a very specific amount
and
of time.
And wait for it. It's coming up.
You won't believe story number three.
You know what? No, I think it's fine for us to do that because we are pretty non-sensationalistic as far as podcasts go. We really don't do a lot of deep teases. And it's awesome to give people the heads up that like, just wait, there's something good coming up.
And now, Close Focus.
Yeah. So, but before we even get into that, when we were talking about Close Focus this week, you and I kind of, sometimes there's like an obvious story. Sometimes there's a good story, like frequently Alana Cody brings it to our attention. And then this week, you know, there was Thanksgiving, there was a bunch of stuff. Didn't really seem like there was much going on. And we were kind of hunting around. And then I was like, hey, the Gotham Awards happened. And, you know, the Gotham Awards are really cool. And, you know, we were looking at it and we were like, but wait a minute. What's the deal with the Gotham Awards? Hey, Ilya, what's the deal with the Gotham Awards?
Here's the deal with the Gotham Awards. They don't have a category for best cinematography. And
what?
I know. And it's like, if this festival wants to be taken seriously on the world stage, because let me tell you, they're a big deal in New York. They're a big deal in the US. But when you're talking about really premium, premier, major festivals, they have cinematography awards. Cannes, Sundance, Toronto, of course, the Oscars, even the Independent Spirit Awards, sort of the equivalent of the Gotham Awards on the West Coast, has best cinematography.
The far superior West Coast, where we both live.
That's true.
The best coast. I'm okay saying that. Come and get me, New York.
But and you know, it's like,
take off your mittens and come, you know, after me.
Tribeca's got it, but like the Gotham Awards don't have it. So in my opinion, that festival is going to remain like second tier, second best until
they,
yeah, I know they got to up their game. They bring in a cinematography award. They do more to then further legitimize the art form to the world. Not like it needs a lot more legitimizing, but let me tell you, all the best festivals, they have it, they recognize it. Hell, there are festivals that is all they do. It is about the cinematography. The cinematographer comes out at the end, does the Q&A, accepts the awards. The director is almost an afterthought. This exists in Poland. It exists in, you know, various parts of the earth.
But yeah. Camera Image has had its own scandals.
They've had their own
late,
scandals, but I'm saying it takes nothing away from, like, you know, their art and love for cinematography. They have other things.
Okay, but where does it stop? Yeah. Do we make every festival the Oscars where there's best editing? And, you know, as someone who does a lot of editing myself, it's like, you know, editing is an art form, and editing can make or break your film often. Do we include costume design? Do we, you know, like, or do we say, because it's like usually it's picture, director, and actor. Like, that's what you get at the Gothams.
Yep.
You get, like, picture, director,
and
documentary.
And this is why, to me, the Golden Globes all...
Writer.
Yeah, no, I mean, the Golden Globes also fail in this. So, and that, why I consider them a second-rate sort of, you know, awards show. And it's...
I mean, I think they're kind of a joke, no matter how you slice it, but yeah.
But look, I would say that cinematography stands in for a lot of below-the-line crafts, for a lot of technical Hollywood. Cinematography sort of ends up being sort of this catch-all, because there's a lot of festivals that don't have all the other below-the-line crafts, but cinematography sort of like becomes the amalgam, the catch-all, because like production design is an incredible art as well too, and that is another one that doesn't get nearly enough recognition. But as cinematographers, as the cinematography department, you know, the cinematography is responsible for all the looks of what things that's happening on there. I feel like a win in cinematography is actually also a win for all the other people who are contributing to that. So I think it would be great if Gotham just had one category. Those one category, it's something that everyone can, you know, have an opinion about, even if they don't all agree on it. It's worthy of inclusion. Other festivals do it. Get with the program, Gotham.
And I think that this also begs us to bring up the Burbank-based cinematography film festival that I'm going to make you found someday.
I don't know if that is, I got so many things on my plate. I don't know if that's one that I could do, but I would definitely contribute and help to someone else who really wanted to pick up the mantle and try to make that happen, because why not? It should exist. 100%.
In Burbank, by the way.
Absolutely. The epicenter of cinematography. It should be right here.
Of all places, for real.
Yeah, it really is. All right. So, Ben, why don't we get to the interview with Alice Brooks?
Here we go.
The Cinematography Podcast Interview.
All right. Well, so thank you so much for coming back on. It was, what, two years ago when we had you on for In the Heights. And I don't know, you probably don't remember. I'm a theater person, but I'm not a musical theater person. So In the Heights kind of blew my mind what you were able to do. And then this kind of re-blew my mind. Just is such amazing, awesome work. I saw it on the big screen. You guys sent me to an actual screening in Burbank, and it was just amazing. And a real crowd pleaser. Like, it was a huge general audience, and it got massive applause, which I assume is kind of a common thing at this point. So, I mean, you know, you've been working with the same director, you've done a bunch of musical projects together, but like Wicked is kind of one of those white whale projects that's been out there, huge Broadway hit, hadn't been adapted yet. Like, tell me about, like, was it exciting? Was it horrifying? Was it scary to find out that you could be adapting, you could be making the canonical adaptation of such a popular play?
John was in post on In the Heights. We were in post on In the Heights and actually Tick, Tick, Boom as well at the same time when John called me and said, Alice, I know what our next movie is going to be. It's going to be Wicked. Mm-hmm. When I got In the Heights, it was, I had been doing little independent movies and suddenly it was my first big studio movie. And
yeah.
And to go from two amazing musicals that I'm so incredibly proud of to suddenly go to one of the biggest stage musicals of all time and then get to adapt it. Anyway, it was, and it's been 4 years, I guess, since, it's been almost 4 years since John told me that, 4 years and actually next month. So I've been on this movie a very long time at this point. Actually, when we spoke last, I knew this was, you probably asked me what I was doing next and I couldn't say, so.
Yeah.
It was Wicked.
That's incredible. That's incredible. And I mean, like, there's kind of like an interesting tradition that seems to have emerged where it's like movies that become plays that become movies again. And, you know, there are things like The Producers, maybe is one of the better examples of it. But like this is, to my knowledge, kind of a first in that it was like, you know, you have The Wizard of Oz, which was a book, obviously, then became a huge movie, one of the hugest movies of its time, shot, I believe, by Harold Rawson. And then, you know, it lives in culture. Like it's one of the stickiest cultural references ever. My son is six and he's seen it. And then it becomes they build on the mythology in the play. They make this play that builds on it. And now it's coming back. So simultaneously you're kind of honoring, the film tradition of it, which everyone has seen, and the theater tradition, which many, many, many people have seen, you know, and even though, like, I've never seen the play, I've certainly seen images from the play. So, like, what is the cinema theater balance? Like, what are you trying to honor? And, like, what are the creative places that you and the director were able to kind of scrape out to be yours? What could be uniquely yours in this film?
So what's amazing about the stage show of Wicked, unlike many Broadway shows, it was never recorded. So the only
really?
Way, correct. So there is no movie version of even the stage play. So you can see some bootleg, you know, YouTube videos of people in the audience filming it, but they never, I mean, I grew up watching yeah. Into the Woods on PBS because they recorded it and aired it with the original casts. So, but, yeah. And other musicals like that, but Wicked was never documented that way. They never had cameras on it.
They didn't even, like, for their own reference, bring a camera crew in to film.
They've got a documentary leading up to it, but they don't, they never recorded it. So we are the only, our version of Wicked, our movie version of Wicked, the musical is its own life. I mean, there's not, we aren't matching, you know, something that already has existed. So it's pretty special to have such a large property that doesn't have any, you know, any real recording of it. But we look, John and I, you know, we wanted to make sure we respected the musical. There are so many amazing fans and just such a love of the show. People go 7, 8, yeah. 40, 50 times to the show. I mean, repeat audiences. So you want to make sure that is being honored, but movies are different. And there is this whole world of Oz that other people have such, you know, that's ingrained in them. It's the Wizard of Oz has been on TV our entire lives. And so, but what we, so there are those two things. And then there are the original books, the L. Frank Baum books. And I leaned into those.
Mm.
I read every single paragraph has an incredibly rich color description. Beautiful, poetic, just the world of Oz in color. It's unbelievable. And color means something. Color is symbolism in Oz. No color is arbitrary. And so as John and I talked, we talked about, we wanted to make a big old Hollywood movie musical. Mm. And we wanted to build sets like Spartacus and Cleopatra that studios just don't do anymore. Real, practical, tangible sets. We shot on 17 sound stages in the end. The sets occupied the entire space from fire lane to fire lane and from floor to the ceiling.
Oh, wow.
That's 185 feet by 145 feet, roughly, were the size of a lot of our stages. Some of them were bigger, though. And you know, 50, 60 foot sets tall. And we had four huge backlots, Munchkin Land, the train station when Elphaba and Glinda get on before One Short Day, and then Shiz and Emerald City were each the size of four American football fields each.
Oh my God.
So you're talking about epic, epic builds that do not exist in this day. And so we had real tangible spaces to light and to create in. And, you know, we didn't live in a blue screen world that so many movies
yeah.
do these days. And so that kind of practical filmmaking that, it was inspiring. And then the production designer and the costume designer and all the craftspeople started being very inspired by nature, which is also part of the original books and landscapes. And so John and I, when we break down a script, we talk about emotion. It's all about emotion and humanity. And he asked me what my goal for the movie was. And I said, my goal is that it's the greatest love story ever told between these two women, these two best friends.
Hmm.
And from that goal, I started making all my decisions, whether it was lenses or camera movement or lack of camera movement, or our cast, Elphaba and Glinda looking right at into the lens at each other. Or the color of the light. All of those choices were made from that intention.
Oh, that's a really interesting thing. Yeah. I mean, it completely makes sense because kind of the arc of the movie kind of goes with those two characters, and you know, sort of the big climax at the end is it's a big moment, but it's also a small moment between them that's sort of being settled up. And I'm really intrigued about what you're saying about the color stuff that you got from the books, because it is very colorful, and it never, you know, like I've seen The Wizard of Oz God knows how many times in my life. It never occurred to me that it's like, yeah, there's an Emerald City and the witch is also green. But I feel like you guys make a connection, like there's a connection here between there's a symbolism between the green. Can you walk me through any of the other color symbolism that you guys found?
Pink symbolizes hope and connection, and mm-hmm. that pink color, the very last shot of Elf, pink light, I should say. Mm-hmm. Pink is that connection between Elphaba and Glinda. And in popular, we do a 20-minute long sunrise that starts pre-dawn as the women talk about the bed, and the sun slowly rises through that entire sequence, through popular, until Glinda walks up her suitcases into this sun spotlight of this pinkness. And then the very last shot of Elphaba flying in the movie, she flies into a pink sunset. And even though they're tragically being ripped apart, right, there is still that hope. There is still that connection between these two women. And the sunrise idea came because John and I were talking about, in Wicked, good and evil, good is not good and evil is not evil, that the light is not necessarily the light and the dark is not the dark. And as I woke up one night with this idea that the sun should rise for Glinda and set for Elphaba. And so you meet Glinda in her backlit bubble, Inchkin Land, in the early morning. And Glinda meets Fiero in the morning, and you've got the sunrise for her. The sun rises for her during popular. And for Elphaba, we meet her as a little girl as the sun's setting outside the governor's mansion. And then you see she meets Fiero in the forest in the darkness. And then they have this cub. There's this cub scene, which is I think it's an 8-minute long sunset through. They are in the forest with this cub, and then it takes us all the way into night for I'm Not That Girl. And then the last hour of the movie, from Wizomania to the last shot of the movie, is one long sunset. And that sunset takes her as she finds her power. So the darkness is the place that Elphaba finds her power, not in the light.
Mm.
And well,
let me ask you something too.
The only good character in this movie.
It's true. That's so cool. When you're doing something like, I know this is such a rudimentary question, but when you're doing something like saying an hour of this movie is going to be one long progressing sunset on set day to day, because I don't know how many days you shot this over, but I assume it was several. How do you track where you're supposed to be in that sunset? And how do you keep track of, I mean, if you're on a stage, I guess maybe it's more about working with the lighting designer and say, dial in, you know, 6:35 PM. But like, how do you do it? How did you do it on this?
And it was complicated, and I had the most amazing gaffer and David Smith and our dimmer board op and Daniel Balking were just incredible at being able to build these cues. In Wicked, we have almost 6,000 lighting cues in the entire movie. And some are very subtle, you'll never know, but you'll feel them. And there's this constant undulating light, and you can feel it. It affects your soul in a way. We shot 155 days, 8.5 months. In that period of time, I only took 7 days off. We worked Saturdays and Sundays of writing. And everyone is like, aren't you exhausted, while I was making the movie? But the pre-light time was my sacred space. It was the time it was just me and the electricians, and I had quiet, and I was in these vast, huge sets, and I could take my script and walk around and pretend I was Elphaba standing in the space, or Glinda standing in the space, and it was Cynthia's version of Elphaba and Ari's version of Glinda, and how they would feel. And then I started lighting the scenes based off of that. And, you know, not with 500, 600 people waiting for you to make decisions. I just had this very, very, anyway, it was very special to have that time. And then, and then to work with the gaffer and our, and the dimmer board op to build, you know, to start building these cues in and figuring that part out. And it is a lot of tracking, and it was a lot of stress. I mean, I remember when we were doing the forest one, you know, you don't start at the beginning of a scene. You start, you know, you do your master sometimes, and then suddenly you have pickups in the middle, like 3 minutes in and four minutes in or whatever. And so you need to be able to go straight to that cue, which is really tricky because that set has 6,000 lights in it. 1,000 or over 1,000 just par cans lining the set, and everything's getting growing darker, and the color temperature of the sky is changing. And then we've got two huge dinos in the way deep space that are slowly being lowered as the sun is setting, and warming and dimming down. So you've got all this stuff, and you have to just be able to repeat cues. And it is a lot to track. And also, you know, making sure everyone is on board with this idea. In Emerald City, that to me was one of my biggest wins in some ways, I guess, which was, with this idea that the sun was going to constantly be setting. One short day, actually, it was a mania, was supposed to be a day scene. And I asked John if I could go through the script and make notes for time of day and make time of day suggestions. And so that one short day in Wizamania was all supposed to be day, and Defying Gravity up at the top tower was all supposed to be night. And so but because we were shooting outside on this big backlot, the only way to make Wizamania up to The Wizard Will See You Now as sundown, as late afternoon light, was to shoot all night long, night for sundown. And so that takes a lot of effort to get everyone going, okay, we're going to shoot this number at night instead of during the day with, you know, whatever it was, 400 dancers and Adina. Oh, I don't know if we're allowed to say, are we allowed to say she's in the movie yet? I don't remember. Anyway, with lots of cast, like
I assume it's who I heard the giant applause break in the middle of the movie. And I was like, I wonder who that is. I guess that's an important person.
Yes. Anyway, we won't say that, but just having, and we're in London in the middle of summer at the beginning of July, the shortest days of the year. So we have limited time to shoot this number. But it all worked out. And that too, you know, the ambience is shifting, and we have lamps that tungsten units all around the set that are acting as if the sun is bouncing off different glass pieces of reflective material around our set. So you have a sense of warm light coming from somewhere. And then the glow of all the practicals in Emerald City just starts to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And then I also had to work with the production designer and the set decorator to build more practicals into the set. So me and the gaffer and the practical electrician department started working with Lee Sandals, the set decorator, to add more and more practicals into the set. So you feel this sort of, you know, wonderful city glow.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, I look at a scene like that one you're talking about, and like, I just don't even know how one would go about. Actually, even just kind of going back to the beginning of the movie, which I think was No One Mourns for the Wicked, the first big scene, which to me looks, I'm assuming that the plans, the architectural plans for Munchkin Land for the original Wizard of Oz don't exist. And probably if I looked at them next to each other, I might be like, oh yeah, they're different. But it felt like the same place. It felt like, oh, I've been here before. It was a weird feeling of like, I know where everything is here. And it's just such an enormous, it's an enormous camera situation. It's an enormous lighting situation. And also you have like however many dozens, hundreds of dancers, and all that has to be choreographed. And like, I'm just thinking about the massive amount of work that all went into just that one sequence. And you have, you know, I don't know, probably like at least 10 sequences of that or greater complexity throughout the whole film.
No, I mean, I think, right, opening the movie with No One Mourns the Wicked on the yellow brick road, as you see the iconic shot of Glinda coming in her bubble, but you can't see her. I think that immediately, I mean, The Wizard of Oz is so, the 1939 movie is so part of so many people's childhoods that I think instantly you're transported, right? Movies are meant to transport you. You are supposed to sit in a dark theater with strangers and have this community experience of of being transported to another place. And so we're
Preach.
transported to Oz. And no, if you look at the set design, they are very, very different. Like if you actually go back and look at the 1939 movie, but there's something about seeing the yellow brick road and the bubble and Glinda that suddenly you feel like a child again. And I think people are transported into that childlike feeling instantly in this movie, and that is the magic of cinema.
So, what I mean, I assume that there were some things that were visual effects or composites or something in here. And I would and when I was watching it, I was also wondering if Elphaba's makeup, if any of that was a digital trick, or if that, because it looked so like it really looked perfect. And I used to be a makeup artist, and I'm like, I couldn't have gotten that right. Like, I don't, you know, you would see the makeup, and like that would be like a constant touch-up situation. So I guess I'm asking, like, what was the kind of practical to visual effects balance, and like how were you hand I know that you're not handling the visual effects yourself, but you're going to be later on responsible for making sure that they all look like the same thing. So like how is it what was that integration like, and to what degree were you honoring the original movie and the way that the effects looked in that movie?
So our prep process was very much about finding the green. It was, do we do it with visual effects or do we do it practically? Cynthia wanted to be painted green. She and Fran, the makeup artist, wanted to do it practically as well. But that is an incredibly scary proposition. It's 3 hours almost in the makeup chair every day for her, and then 45 minutes to get degreened at the end of the night.
And I
And but
assume constant touch-ups too. That would be, you
And
know.
constant touch-ups, and also Fran had to do tests to see, like, if she's standing next to a woman with platinum blonde hair and in pink, and so much of the movie is about hands. Hands was a major theme in our movie. If you go back and watch, there's many, many shots of hands, that connection, and so doing transfer tests. But for me, it was about the lighting. I wanted to do, all these things with light. But as Fran and I started working together on the second week of prep, I started shooting stills in different light as she started testing different greens on a stand-in on a model. And the problem was the green did not react like skin. It felt like paint. And also I couldn't balance it right. It only looked good under cool light. The second it went warm, put any warm light, it went gray. And so week after week, we kept trying things. And then Fran found this product in Canada that has a neon base to it. And she was able to mix it with the green that she loved, and Cynthia loved, but suddenly it reacted like skin. And it had this iridescent quality to it. And you could almost feel Cynthia's skin glowing from within, and it didn't look like paint. And I could put her in any single light, and it would work. And that transformed everything. And we all sat at Company 3 looking at this test. It was a 65 millimeter lens, which became Cynthia's hero close-up lens. And it was just this long, slow push in as I the way we did camera tests. The gaffer would set up different color temperature lights places or LEDs and do change the lighting and go darkness and brightness and overexposed and underexposed. And it was just this long, slow push in that ended like very, very extreme close up on Cynthia. And it was perfect. And we all agreed in that room that we were going to do it practically. And of course, there's always some little teeny touch ups that visual effects needed to do. Like, if she cried, a lot of the time there was no mark, but every once in a while, yeah, of course, something. Or when she pulled off the hat, sometime there would be a little teeny mark, but it was completely remarkable that we were able to do it so beautifully in camera.
So you mentioned that her kind of hero lens was a 65, but like, and you also talked earlier a little bit about just your choice of lenses, about making it a love story, which I think is such a brilliant idea for something like this, because it feels like a big, it is a big boisterous musical, you know, with a giant world and all that stuff. But like keeping it so rooted and grounded in these two characters is, to me, that's what kept me emotionally invested in the whole thing, because, you know, it's like I'm ready to be like, oh, Alphaba good, Galinda bad, I'm going to hate them. And then like partway through, I'm like, wait a minute, I kind of see both of them. Like I'm liking both of them. And so it allows for something that I guess we don't see, sort of that moral ambiguity. It's not really moral ambiguity, but it's just like allowing people to be complex in something as epic. And, you know, I think we're used to in epic kind of things, it's like evil, good, you know, Marvel Cinematic Universe. But like, let's talk a little bit about like how you translate that language into lenses. What was your thought process in terms of like, how did you land at the 65, for Alphaba's, you know, hero close-up lens? And when you have people looking straight into the lens, I always think of Silence of the Lambs, which is probably the worst film to reference here, but Silence of the Lambs is also a love story that, in a weird way. But what motivated that? When did you decide to do that? And, you know, like, kind of give me the lens rundown, if you could.
So John, among all his creative team, kept instilling in us, don't make the obvious choices, that we were all together creating a world of Oz that no one had ever seen before, that was magical and wondrous and a little bit different. And there's a line in The Heights that talks about details. And details are how we are not invisible. Mm-hmm. And details is how we show the world we are not invisible. And every single craftsperson, from production design to set deck to our model makers to the lighting department to the grip department, we're all making these little teeny detailed choices that then, when you put them all together, create Oz for Wicked, Wicked's version of Oz. And so one of the choices I made was, I immediately called Panavision and I called Dan Sasaki there as soon as, you know, 4 years ago when I knew about Wicked, and I couldn't tell him what movie I was working on. John and I create a shared album immediately when we start doing a movie. And then slowly as other crew is hired, more and more people populated as well. But I had all these visual references. For most of them were really just about feeling. And this Dan Sasaki is all about feeling. You just describe feeling to him and he gets it. And then he goes into his machine shop, his lens shop, and creates a lens. So I called him and I said, you know, I'm doing this movie and this is what I want it to feel like. I want it to be this love, incredible love story. I want effervescent lenses. And there to be this softness to it. And he said, well, he had this idea for this new lens, these new anamorphic lenses. And would I be interested in maybe, you know, figuring these out together, that he could make them to any specs I wanted. So we developed these lenses together. And when we were doing camera tests, we didn't even have the full set of lenses. We called them the Unlimiteds, after the American Wicked. And no one else has shot on these lenses. They're locked on in a closet in Panavision London. But they, when we saw that makeup test on Cynthia, the 65 became her lens. And for Ariana, when I tested that lens on her, it just wasn't right. So her close-up lens became the 75 millimeter lens. And we still, which is not an obvious choice. You usually shoot close-ups on the same lenses, matching close-ups. But what we did was we matched the size. So even though they're different focal lengths, they still occupy the same space within a frame. But that's just one of those little details that's a little off, right? And no one's ever going to know it, but you feel it when you watch the movie.
Well, I'm just curious though, like what was the criteria? And I don't know if it might just be an emotional choice or an aesthetic choice, but what's the criteria of saying like, you get a 65 and a 75 looks better on you? Like what was wrong when you put the 75 on Alphaba or the 65 on Galinda?
They're even though they're roughly the same size and height, you know, height, they just have very different shaped faces. And there was something about each one that, I mean, the 65 we chose before I ever knew I was going to make this decision. And but there was but when I put the 65 on Ari, it just, there was something that didn't, it just wasn't the right lens for her. She was, whereas the 75, which is just a teeny bit longer, created another layer of sort of Glinda softness to her.
I just think that, I mean, I guess this is where we get to the art and not the technology of it, of like you're just looking at both and going like, this is better for you and this is better for you. But it's I mean, it's like that's such a subtle distinction, you know, 10 millimeter difference, but you know, but absolutely crucial to making it work. How do you articulate what you want in terms of optics to get it to change it to what you're imagining?
We did not want an anamorphic blue flare. The idea of blue crossing the green and the pink to me was not going to work. So he's like, okay, what color flare do you want? We can do pink. We can do green. We can do magenta. We can do purple. And we settled. We didn't even settle. We chose amber because I felt like amber would work beautifully with both the green and the pink. And then there was, he wanted to know what stop I wanted to shoot at, because he can make a lens to any stop. And I shot the whole movie at a 2.8. So our lenses opened up a little bit more than a 2.8, some of them, but most were about a 2.8. So we shot wide open. And then what else did we talked about close focus. So the 65 millimeter lens is our closest focus lens. It's a 1 foot, 10 inch close focus. And so when we're in the Ozdust ballroom, there's a shot on Cynthia, which is, we move 360 degrees, and we shot, John wanted to shoot that sequence when she comes into the Ozdust ballroom and does her dance, and then Glinda joins her. He wanted to shoot that shot all in one without a rehearsal. And he wanted to shoot her 65 millimeter close up first, because he wanted Cynthia to feel the emotion of walking into this space for the first time and everyone laughing at her. And we had done dance rehearsals and seen Cynthia do it in the rehearsal space, but never on set. And that was weeks and weeks before. And this one shot had 500 lighting cues in it approximately. And we're going circling around, and because she's wearing this huge hat too, and need to be able to see her. And so David Smith, the gaffer, was moving the sliders up and down on our little mini desk boards the entire time. And as Karsten, our Steadicam operator, is moving around, and Karsten is pausing when things pause, and then slowly drifting back, and then Ari joins, and it's all this beautiful dance. And then Lewis, who is our incredible focus puller, who does not pull off a monitor, he's right at the camera, is pulling focus while he's moving in a circle for 10 minutes.
Oh my God.
So incredibly complicated. And
I'm getting tired just hearing you describe all that.
And we know this is all going to be cut up because you need Glinda's side too, and you need audience. But then a tear drips down Cynthia's face, and that's not in the script. And at the end, and we're able to push in really, really close. And we have a 1 foot 10 we can be 1 foot 10 from her on this lens. And then Ari wipes the tear away. And I mean, it was just this magical moment. You know, everyone on set is crying watching this happen. And if we hadn't been the space to just have that creative freedom and flexibility of doing the shot that way, and having this lens that focuses so close so that that teardrop is perfect, I mean, none, that performance would never have been captured. That is choreography at the ultimate. It is the choreography of Cynthia. It is the choreography of light and camera and makeup and costumes and acting and background cast and direction. I mean, that shot to me is the ultimate why we make movies, is for that special, special moment to happen that we were all there to witness.
Yeah. And there's something like really deeply, again, it's something I'm not used to seeing in movies like this. And maybe it's why I'm not the world's biggest musical person. It's like, I'm not used to seeing something that feels so naturalistic and spontaneous, you know, because
I'd like
when
to
you're
say this movie feels very handmade. Someone said that a while ago, and the more every time I watch the movie, it is, right? It feels even it like how in this vast, huge movie are we making something that feels so touchable?
Yeah, that's a great way to describe it. I think this movie's going to be a huge hit, and you know, everyone's going to see it, but obviously, go see Wicked, everybody. Where can people find you online if they're looking for you?
Yeah, on Instagram, it's underscore Alice Brooks underscore. And then, but then, I mean, like, this is my dream. I've been working at this since I was 15 years old. Like,
Yeah.
I'm 45, and I just am in complete gratitude for getting to make this movie. And then I see these young people walk up to me, these young women walk up to me after screenings or they reach out to me on Instagram, and like suddenly all of this suddenly I realized those are the people this movie was made for, like to be inspired and touched and to have other people dream really big dreams. And anyway, I don't know if that's clear, but it's
No,
just.
I get it, and I mean it's part that's why we do this podcast, you know, and to kind of bring across, you know, all the various stories of people who, you know, who do what you do. And you know, this again, like, you know, I'm no prognosticator, but like I look at this and I'm like, I can't believe this won't be nominated and or win a bunch of Oscars, but also be a huge crowd pleaser. Like, I think this is gonna be a movie that's gonna reach a lot of people. And
I mean, I hope it will bring so many people so much joy. So,
and also hopefully inspire people to kind of follow the path that you're creating here, you know? I mean, like it's noteworthy, and you know, how many people have tried to follow up The Wizard of Oz in this cinematic form, and I feel like this really does it, you know, and it does it also with the musical. It brings so many worlds together. So, congratulations.
well, thank you so much.
All right, so that was Alice Brooks. Alice, thank you so much for being on the show and telling us all about Wicked. And you're right, Ben, that was a great story near the end.
Thank you.
And now, short ends.
It is time for our short end, which is our weekly obsession. Is there something that you've got going on in the world that you're obsessed about, that you're interested in?
I found something super cool,
Oh,
and I
okay.
think people on here would dig it. And it's on, of all places, Deadline.
Oh, interesting.
Nikki, formerly of Nikki Fink fame, Deadline.
Yeah.
It's a thing called Read the Screenplay, and it's on Deadline. And basically, like the big screenplays of the year, they just post a link and you can read the whole screenplay. You can read the shooting script. And the ones that are up there right now are Deadpool and Wolverine, Gladiator 2, The Apprentice, The Last Showgirl, Maria, which is by Steven Knight, and there's a bunch of other ones that you can find on there if you click around. And it's really an amazing resource. I know that there's plenty of places to find screenplays online, and you know. I probably never miss an episode of Script Notes, the podcast with John August and Craig Mazin. And I think I've also talked about on the podcast Tom Vaughn and probably my many, many writing collaborations with Bob DeRosa. But writing, I think, if you look at screenwriting today versus even 10, 15 years ago, there's certain conventions that don't go against the formatting of the previous decades, but sort of have they have streamlined it. And like Tom Vaughn talks about scripts being vertical and being readable. So that means like not having big long blocks of text, not having, you know, giant paragraphs of stuff to read through and being like really Spartan with the way that you write. And I was looking at the script. They have the script for Inside Out 2 there, and I was like, you know, no one writes a better script than freaking Pixar. The people at Pixar, like, and Inside Out 2 is an amazing script, and it's interesting just to look at how they lay it out on the page. There's like a real art to that. That's you know, I'm sure some of our listeners are like, up yours, Rock. I just want to hear about cameras and lights, but I think that this is the fundamentals of stories, and I think it's important to look at how the top people in the business, you know, I looked at the Gladiator 2 one as well. Like, what are they doing to format them? So anyway, check it out. It's on, it's free. It's on Deadline. Read the screenplay. You will learn something, even if you don't read the whole screenplay. Read the first act of any of a movie that you saw, and just look at how it was written out. And it's always kind of a miracle when you see like how different writing styles and everything can be employed to tell these stories that we are all working our asses off to tell.
Yeah, it sounds awesome. I will totally check that out. That's and a free resource for people, especially, you know, young screenwriters who are just starting out and really want to dive into this. Young screenwriters should be reading scripts all the frickin' time. I don't know how many of them do, yeah, but they really should. And a resource that propels that is fantastic.
I don't mean to be like all old manish about it, but I just want to point out that like when you and I started out, if you wanted to read a screenplay, you had to get a printout of a screenplay.
Oh yeah.
They weren't sending around PDFs. It was not easy to come by them. And I remember getting like the screenplay for The Silence of the Lambs and just being like, oh my God, I'm holding it in my hands. The very script, you know, that was turned into one of my favorite movies. And, you know, we do live in a time where, you know, access to stuff like this is
better,
pretty
way
easy
better.
To come by.
Yeah, pretty easy.
And I think that this is a pretty well curated list. And again, these are like top performing movies, but look at the top performing movies. If you're writing a script, I don't care if you're trying to write like an A27, you know, psychological body horror film, there's going to be something you will pick up from the technique of these writers, just the way they use the page, the way they use description or dialogue or whatever, like that makes it kind of spring off the page that you can take and run with, and it's not stealing. So because you're stealing an approach, not an actual thing. So
you may remember this, but back in the 80s, the 90s, on Hollywood Boulevard, there was a cottage industry of shops that sold screenplays, that sold like draft screenplays. You could go in there and find like draft number 4 of Jaws. I'm sure it was questionably legal how they did this.
When you read a script and then see it executed, even when they execute it faithfully and it doesn't work, you're like, in whose hands would it have worked?
Yeah, you know? That's my question always too, because sometimes I feel like the right person is out there and they would have got it and they would have done it. And other times I feel like maybe no one could make this. Maybe no one could make this. It's too brilliant or whatnot. But
I'm not going to name names, but I've read a script that I know I've shown you that I loved and went so far as to option at one point, and it got made into a film.
Did it?
Like 5 years ago.
Really?
And it has never been released. And I'm like, what is the story?
Oh, wow.
And it's like, there's a couple of behind the scenes pictures and I'm like, what the hell happened? But it was such, I think, you know, the script I'm talking about.
I know exactly the script you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was such a great script and it was such an engaging read,
it was.
But also
it was brilliant.
Something that would be extremely hard to pull off perfectly.
I feel like the Coen brothers could have pulled that movie off.
Probably.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, well, now we're talking about nothing. So
that's true. Now we've lost 99% of our audience. If you're still with us,
hey, you know, anyone wants to reach out to me on Blue Sky and direct message me, I'll tell you the title of the movie that I wouldn't just say.
Well, in an effort to just move us along, I'm going to plow into my short end this week, which is a new Netflix series starring Colman Domingo called The Madness. Have you seen The Madness?
No, I've heard about it though.
You know, it's a little polarizing. There are some people out there who just don't get it, I guess, because I saw the reviews online. They weren't spectacular. It's really smart. It's really good. I don't think my point of view is totally outside the mainstream, but you know, the bad guys are white supremacists. I gotta say, like, I feel like those are pretty good bad guys to have. So it's
I don't know, man, in this day and age.
Colman Domingo is great. And actually I got to give him some extra props too, because he just won an award at the Gotham Awards. He just won a best actor performance for Sing Sing. So, but I'm a huge fan of Colman Domingo. I think his work is great. I've been watching his stuff for I feel like, you know, decades now. He's been around a long time, character actor. This is his first like starring role for a series. Like, he is the lead. He is the man for this. And he plays a part-time CNN anchor, and he kind of is in the wrong place, wrong time, getting framed for a murder. And there's a really sort of great way that the story unfolds through flashbacks, which don't feel like hokey or cheeky or like they're deliberately trying to, you know, keep information obscured from you. They do a really, really good job of putting this show together. And I can't wait to see where it goes next. I've only seen episodes 1 and 2. So all of my review here is based on the first 2 episodes. But if you're looking for a new series, if you like thrillers, if you like Colman Domingo, check out The Madness on Netflix. It's great.
I'll check it out maybe when I finish Penguin. Penguin's freaking awesome.
I haven't started it yet, so I got.
I can't believe how much I love Penguin.
Oh, all right, yeah, I keep hearing good things. Really good.
It's pretty awesome.
All right, Ben, that's just about going to do it for this episode. Where can people find you if they want to track you down?
Well, you can find me at Blue Sky at Neptune Salad. You can also find me on my regular old normal website on the information superhighway. It's benrock.com. How about yourself, Philly? Where can people find you?
You can find me over at Hot Rod Cameras. Today is Hot Rod Cameras' big customer appreciation shindig. So it's a big party going up here today. That's actually,
even though I'm not really a customer of yours or haven't been, I haven't bought anything from you in a while.
Once a customer, always a customer. So, you know, you're not kicked out because you didn't buy something from us lately. Although, probably should.
What have you done for us lately, Rock?
What have you done, Rock? Yeah.
I was just using my pocket camera that I bought from you like 5 years ago.
Nice.
Just yesterday, actually.
I'm glad it's still kicking and working for you. Terrific. Anyway, so Ben, who do we have to thank to make this? Who made this show possible? Who should we thank that, you know, made sure that you and I are sitting here talking right now and that the world can hear us if they so choose?
I mean, number one is always Alana Cody, who's setting up all kinds of interviews and great stuff. You know, we're kind of the middle of Oscar season, and so
it's busy.
We're busy. We got a lot of stuff coming up. You got one coming up. I got one coming up. We got to thank Michael Dispenza, who's doing all the slicing and dicing and hopefully cutting out the boring shit that I say. Mm. He can leave in all the boring shit you say. Yeah. I don't care. As long as I look thin, I don't care.
Making Julian fries out of this. He's slicing, saying it's slap chop, chop-a-matic. He's, you know, bass-a-matic. He's making it a
bass-a-matic. Yeah. Deep cut. And then and last but not least, we should thank Kazal Attrakci, who created all the music that you've heard on this episode. He's an amazing composer, by the way. Have we mentioned that? Amazing.
Never
composer.
Once.
Scores movies. Scored numbers of movies. Full feature films. He's great. And he does lots of other stuff. Check him out at musicbykays.com. K-A-Y-S. That's about it. Ilya, you want to take us out?
Thanks for tuning in.
This has been the Cinematography Podcast, presented by Hot Rod Cameras. Find your next camera, lens, or accessory on the web at hotrodcameras.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our show on iTunes and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.